Prices shift, petrol jumps, shares fall. A company cuts jobs and suddenly the business story is everyone's story.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. From Monday to Thursday on ABC Business Daily, we break down the biggest stories in business, finance and the economy and why they matter.
Then on Fridays, I'll go deeper on That's Business, with the people making decisions, taking risks and shaping where the economy goes next.
Find it all in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Leanne Tenbrink is a Canadian research psychologist based at the University of British Columbia. Leanne's special area of focus is what she terms dark personality types. People who are particularly cruel, malicious, manipulative, without empathy. We're talking about psychopaths, narcissists, sadists. Most of us have run into such people at some time in our lives. The abusive boyfriend, the gaslighter, the mid-level boss dropped in by senior management to intimidate the staff who keeps getting promoted. And then there are the more serious cases. The parent who cries on national television for their child to be returned, who's later discovered to have murdered that child. Psychologists estimate that something like 1% of any population shows serious levels of psychopathy. But Leanne Tenbrink makes the point that any one of us is capable of losing our moral bearings or enabling malicious people by cheering them on, by hiring them, or by voting them into office. Leanne's book is called Poisonous People: Psychopathy, Narcissism, Manipulation, Sadism. How to Resist Them and Improve Your Life. Hello, Leanne.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Tell me how you were first introduced to the concept of the psychopath as a kid.
That happened in grade 11 in my high school sociology class. It was Miss Lorifus. I remember this so vividly. One day she rolled the cart with the big tube television and the VCR on it into the classroom, which does date me. But, you know, it's always a very exciting day when we're going to get to watch a movie in class.
I love those days, Leanne.
I know.
We're all just trying
to get back there. But what she put on was a documentary. It was The Nature of Things, and it was on the nature of psychopathy. And I was just fascinated. I had never, you know, kind of imagined someone who had such a, you know, different experience of life than I did. I was just like enthralled by these personalities who had this lack of remorse, who were so impulsive and risk-taking and so manipulative. And I decided that I would study these people. And so I ended up going to Dalhousie University, which was in Nova Scotia, same province where I grew up on the east coast of Canada. And I did a certificate in forensic psychology along with my honors degree. And so I've been hooked on the topic ever since.
Forensic psychology is a bit like criminal psychology, isn't it? It's by another name. You got a job for a while working in a parole office as a young uni student. What kind of work was that like?
That was part of that certificate in forensic psychology. So as part of it, I had to do an honors thesis on a forensic psychology topic, but I also had to volunteer in a couple of different places around town where I would have some kind of interaction with people who were also interacting with the justice system. One of those was in the local parole office. And so my role was to sit in and kind of experience what goes on in a parole office. But one of the things that I did was that I went to what was called the Sex Offender Treatment Maintenance Program. So every like Wednesday night, I think it was, I would go down the street from my apartment to this government building where about 20 men who were currently on parole but had been convicted of sexual offenses would join with me and a couple of psychologists and engage in some talk therapy once a week. So that was one of my first introductions to actually working with people who had some high levels of these psychopathic personality traits.
It's often said that such people, sex offenders, aren't people who are so much enslaved to their sexual appetites, but who are interested in the power dynamic involved in those cases of abuse. Was that borne out by what you saw?
There was definitely a range because this group of individuals had, you know, there was an array of folks here. So some who had offended against children, others who had offended against adults, and also those who kind of go back and forth in terms of the victims that they choose tend to have higher levels of psychopathy. But I certainly saw in the group dynamic this power and zest for power at play. So I had one kind of personal experience that actually changed the course of my career with one of these personalities. I was just sitting there. I was very, you know, meek, mild, 20-year-old woman at the time. And each of the men were going around and they were talking about, well, they were supposed to be talking about their victims, the impact that their actions had had on their victims. And so most of these guys were very contrite, showed a lot of remorse, recognized that they had done real harm to the people that they offended against. But one guy, you know, he kind of been like eyeing me this whole time. When it got to be his turn, he took that as like an opportunity to intimidate me. So instead of talking about his victim and the impact that he had on her, he was talking about his victim selection approach and like what he looked for in someone that he would sexually offend against. How, oh yeah, I look like his type, and his most recent victim kind of looked a lot like me in terms of, you know, how tall I was and my hair color and whatnot. And I was just terrified, you know, like I just like sunk down into my chair because this amounted to like a veiled threat. And so the psychologists essentially shut him down. They had to talk to him later. And they, you know, they gave me a drive home that night because they were a little worried about my safety. And so I saw in that room him trying to get this power over me, which totally worked, right? I was very scared. And that he got quite a jolt, quite a joy out of doing that.
He enjoyed tormenting you. I suppose you can be kind of fascinated with the whole concept of the psychopath, but when you actually see it up close and you have that energy directed at you, that's something else entirely different, isn't it?
Oh, you're totally right. I mean, this man really changed the course of my career. I love my career, so maybe I should give him some credit. But it made me turn from, you know, oh, maybe I could engage in treatment. I could be a clinical psychologist working with these guys in a setting like that, in parole offices, in prisons. After that, I kind of was like, oh, I think I want to study this topic, but at more a little bit more of like an arm's distance. And so I'm a social and personality psychologist. So I study these things, but not as like, you know, someone who's trying to treat these personality types.
Are psychopaths generally aware that they're psychopaths? Do they have that degree of self-knowledge, and are they fascinated by that?
So they're certainly aware. I mean, one of the ways that we often assess the level of psychopathy that someone has is to give them these self-report questionnaires. And you can give that to anybody. And people who are higher in psychopathic traits will say, yeah, that sounds like me. Like, I don't have empathy. I don't care when other people cry. I'm not worried about offending other people. I'm willing to take big risks without any calculation involved, right? So they're certainly self-aware and can report on their personality traits. It's more of like whether they care about changing those things. We find that people who are high in these types of antagonistic traits, they don't really see them as a problem. It's more of a problem for the people they interact with than them. They're not concerned with the effects of their actions, which is largely hurting other people.
Oh, they're like, I'm like this and it sucks to be you then.
Why exactly. That's more a you problem than a me problem.
I mentioned the idea of the workplace psychopath, and many people have had the bad boss who's dropped in, like I said, by senior management to shake up the joint and be the old man son of a bitch. Have you encountered such workplace psychopaths in your own life, Leanne?
I think everyone has their own story of someone who probably doesn't have clinical levels of these traits, but who has, you know, perhaps elevated levels of these traits and rains down abuse on the people below them. I've certainly had my own share of those run-ins. I mean, in part because I study these individuals. So I've been in situations where I've been studying hedge fund managers, for example, and looking specifically for people with high levels of these traits. So looking at people in high levels of management, even CEOs, and looking specifically for psychopathic traits and examining whether they really do outperform other people, which sometimes people think that's why they should be in those positions, is because they're going to be able to make the most progress, make the most money.
Who asked you to undertake such work to put hedge fund managers under the microscope?
Yeah, we were working with a financial intermediary. So essentially their job was to take large amounts of pension money and to allocate it to different hedge fund managers who would then invest it on behalf of those pension funds. So they were very concerned with the personalities of the people that they were handing millions or billions of dollars over to. And it was kind of part of their risk management strategy to try to get a good understanding of the personal qualities of these individuals. And they were also particularly interested in deception detection. They wanted to know whether some of these managers might be lying about, you know, how optimistic they were for the future returns, for example, or what their strategies were. And so I was tasked with this goal of just sitting in on meetings and taking a look at, you know, are there any kind of deception red flags, things that we should follow up on? Are you seeing any concerning kinds of personality traits that we should keep an eye on?
There is a kind of a theory that you sometimes hear that senior management will drop in a middle manager with this kind of these kind of tendencies because, yes, they may be cruel. Yes, they may break the dishes and what have you, but they're effective. They go in, they cut through the waves of politeness, and they're more about creating wealth for the company. But is that actually true? Have you found that to be true in your research, Leanne?
The short answer is no. I think that belief is really common. And the research specifically that we did with hedge fund managers found that the higher someone's level of psychopathic traits, the less money they made over time. And year over year, you know, over the period of 10 years, you know, that added up to many millions of dollars over time. So investing money with a CEO who has high levels of these traits is likely to give you less money over time, not more. Narcissism was also kind of interesting in that hedge fund managers with more narcissistic traits, they tended to make about the same amount of money as those with fewer of those narcissistic traits, but it was much more volatile. So you had to like endure these ups and downs and, you know, taking a look at your portfolio and being like, oh, it's way down today and oh, it's way up tomorrow. So you had to endure this kind of roller coaster to get to the same place as if you had just invested with a lower narcissism manager to begin with. What we find is that whenever people with these personality traits are put in charge, they tend to dominate other people. They force their subordinates into submission, which is incredibly stressful and leads to high turnover and poor performance. And so you actually get worse performance when you put these personalities in charge, not better.
You've got a classic case in your book of a workplace psychopath. Tell me about the pharmacist you spoke with called Tricia.
Yeah. So I interviewed a lot of people for this book and their experiences with these kind of lower level, probably not clinical level psychopathy, but people that showed these kinds of traits in workplaces, in their relationships. And this was one story that really stuck with me. So Tricia went to work at a pharmacy. It wasn't a pharmacy that was open to the public. It was one that was fulfilling prescriptions for local nursing homes. And so she was working closely with her boss, Kelly. Things seemed fine, you know, when she started, although she did notice over time that, like, whenever Kelly would walk into a room, her new coworkers would like hush up. They become like meek little mice, she said. And she thought that was a little bit strange, but Kelly still seemed like friendly enough, although over time that facade really eroded away. Kelly would blow up at the smallest little thing. You know, she would be typing on her keyboard and Kelly would start yelling at her for her infernal typing noises. And when Tricia would want to come in early and help to prepare for upcoming disbursements of medications, she would like let herself into the building, which she was totally allowed to do, but then she would get berated by her boss. So it was kind of like she felt really off her footing. Like she couldn't figure out why this person was so cruel to her all the time and cruel to everybody else. She would lie a lot. Her emotions were very strange in terms of she would be flying off the handle one second. And then when a client stopped by, she would put on this saccharine smile and seem, you know, so happy and delightful and bubbly. And she really had a control freak edge to her where they came across quite callous. So she wouldn't tell people exactly how to execute their jobs and then would yell at them whenever they weren't able to follow through on whatever they were supposed to do. And sometimes this was life-saving things, like doling out medication for nursing homes to ensure that the residents didn't get this new form of influenza, for example. And so it grated on her to the point where she had to take time off of her job, and she experienced something kind of akin to like a PTSD, she says. She was worried every time she left the house that she would run into her former boss, and she was really on edge, high anxiety. And she ended up going back to work about 3 months later, but still has those experiences of worrying whether she's going to run into her former boss out in the community. So it really stuck with her, in addition to having this incredibly negative impact on her in the moment.
Is it natural for such victims of that behavior to assume for a very long time that I'm the problem here, clearly, because everyone wants best for everyone, surely, in a given situation, and I must be doing something wrong to provoke this boss to shout at me like this all the time? So really, for a long time, you can think that the problem is actually me and not that other person.
Yeah, I think that's quite common. You see that also where someone is involved in a romantic relationship with someone with these traits, and they feel like they're the reason why they keep setting off this perhaps violent behavior or manipulative behavior. They start to experience gaslighting effects where they think, oh, I must be thinking about this wrong, or I'm not remembering things correctly. And so, yes, absolutely, people can start to take on the blame themselves. One thing that might help people to see the pattern for what it is to observe that dark personality treating other people in the same way. And so you can start to see that, like, this is the origin of the problem, and I'm not the only person who is experiencing these effects at work, for example.
You make the point that it's very helpful to understand the traits of these people so we can recognize them pretty quick off the bat. You describe four buckets of personal traits. The first one are their interpersonal skills, how mm-hmm. they relate to others. What are the traits that are in that particular bucket?
That's the first bucket of psychopathic personality traits, because psychopathy is like a constellation of traits. So it's a whole bunch of different things that come together. First, as you said, is interpersonal. And that includes things like being really selfish, manipulative, and superficially charming. So it's all about the way that they relate to others. They tend to be grandiose, but also be more likely to tell lies, for example.
The second bucket are the emotional traits. Is this mm-hmm. kind of a coldness there? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's sometimes a misbelief that people with psychopathy have no emotions, and that's not entirely true. So they do tend to have shallow emotions than other people, but they still experience things like excitement. They can still experience anger, although it tends to be shorter lived than other people. But they have limited shame and remorse. So those kinds of feelings that usually hold you back from doing something cruel to other people, those are really the emotions that are missing or are much muted in people with psychopathic personalities.
You write that they know the words but not the music of emotion. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's not a me quote. That's stolen from someone else. But I think what that means is that, you know, when psychologists talk about empathy, one of the forms of empathy is cognitive empathy. That's my ability to understand what you're feeling and thinking. They have that. So they're able to understand what you're feeling and thinking, but they don't feel it with you. You know that experience of, like, if you're watching television, for example, oh, this is one that I get all the time. Like at the end of a game, when they show the elated winners, right? And then they pan the camera to the team that just lost and they're all devastated. I had this experience, and maybe you do too, of being like so excited when they show the winning team and then just like devastated when they show the losing team. That's because I am feeling, you know, quote unquote, the music of emotion, right? I am feeling what they are feeling. That is something that is impaired in people with psychopathy.
I find humor might be indicative too. Like being around such people, I find humor tends to reveal them. They have a mirthless laugh to them. The things that tend to make them laugh are the misfortune of others.
Yeah, so psychopathy is certainly associated with higher degrees of sadism as well. So that is enjoying someone else's pain. You know, so if you see someone who is laughing at I don't know, someone else getting hurt or someone falling from grace, that can be associated with psychopathy. I will also note, though, that that's actually a pretty common human experience and maybe gets a little bit to, you know, some of the situations in which we can start to behave in ways that are similar to psychopathy. What is different in psychopathy versus like the everyday experience of Schadenfreude, for example, is that they tend to experience it much more often and consistently, not just in kind of special circumstances.
The third bucket of traits is an appetite for risk-taking. What's driving that love of risk in the psychopath?
Well, part of it is sensation-seeking, so getting that rush is quite enjoyable to them. And another thing is that they don't tend to have the fear that others of us have. So they engage in these impulsive behaviors when other people would be held back by fear. They don't have those same kind of internal signals to decrease the likelihood that they'll engage in risky behaviors.
How about having any kind of realistic long-term goals? I mean, are these people likely to coolly plan how they go about their risks, or are they just inclined to do it and just see what happens?
It's a do it and see what happens. There's actually a really fascinating kind of evolutionary perspective on psychopathy, and that is that the rest of us are living this kind of slow life, like plotting it out, taking carefully planned risks and like investing our time and money in relationships and stuff, whereas they're living the fast life, right? And so that is very much a feature of psychopathy, is kind of poor planning and figuring things out on the fly.
Are you implying that there might be, in terms of evolutionary psychology, biology, there's an advantage in having some idiots go about and try catastrophic things recklessly, because 1 in 100 times it'll work out and we might learn something from that? Is that to the broader advantage of the human population?
I think the evolutionary perspective is more about like an individual person's fitness in the evolutionary sense of your ability to pass on your genes. So psychopathy also tends to be associated with promiscuity.
Oh, right.
And so you could, you know, pass on your genes into the next generation without, you know, putting a whole lot of time or effort into parenting, for example, and taking kind of risks in those ways, whereas other people are taking a longer-term investment approach.
I was just thinking, as you were saying that, I was just thinking that the Genghis Khan advantage, one of history's greatest and most successful psychopaths, the conqueror and the murderer of however many captive populations, of course, fathered so many children to a shocking extent, so that it's often thought that a huge percentage of the population of China can draw some genetic connection to the person of Genghis Khan. As a result of that, I suppose you could say that's an example of rewarding the psychopathic personality in terms of him being able to pass on his genes to future generations.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory for sure. And I think that would suggest that there's some sort of personal advantage for Genghis Khan. Whether that was advantageous for the rest of society is kind of an open question.
The fourth bucket of personality traits in the psychopath you've got is a penchant for rule-breaking. Now, are you talking about law-breaking here or something more subtle than that, the breaking of kind of the unwritten conventions of any situation?
Absolutely. Breaking the law is part of that. But flouting social norms is absolutely part of that, too. So it doesn't have to be laws that are written down. These individuals are also more likely to break norms that aren't written down. And just kind of the way that everyone lives their life, we have these certain social rules in our families or in our workplaces that help grease the wheels of social interaction that are not written down but are important for social organization. They're more likely to flout those as well.
One of the most interesting aspects of your book, I think, Leanne, is that normally when you read books about psychopaths, they don't address the moments when normal people who are normally quite reasonably empathetic, when they can behave, when we can behave in a psychopathic way. What are some of these situations when normal people become what you call situational psychopaths?
So we tend to be more likely to be callous and to break the rules whenever we're anonymous and whenever there's a kind of in-group, out-group dynamic going on. People can think about their favorite sports team or their rival sports team. You might be very callous about the members of your rival sports team. And so there's some ways in which people might say, oh, I'm nothing like someone with psychopathy. I can't even imagine what those are like. But if I put you into the kind of right or wrong situation, you might start to behave a little more callously than you normally would. And that's what I termed in the book to be situational psychopathy. You know, people really can lose themselves a little bit in these situations where we start to feel anonymous. We create this enemy in our minds. And we lose our sense of self.
What you're describing sounds a lot like what happens in road rage as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Things like being stressed, being hungry, being frustrated. You know, you're in traffic, someone cuts you off, or you imagine they cut you off because you have this hostile attribution bias. You tend to assume that other people's actions are negative and hostile toward you, as opposed to coming up with more benign explanation for their behavior. And so those kinds of behaviors can lead to road rage incidents.
You mentioned anonymity was important too. You are kind of anonymous, aren't you, in your car? You're in this kind of metal frame and no one knows who you are. There's a degree of comfort there that might let these moments of situational psychopathy to unleash those traits in ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, we do care about our reputations. And whenever people can't see us, those reputational concerns are much diminished. You know, this won't come back to me because no one knows who I am. So absolutely, anonymity can increase the likelihood of these callous and cruel behaviors. But that also gives us this insight into what might be able to reduce those behaviors. So if you just like introduce yourself to, say, your neighbors, if you introduce yourself to the people sitting beside you at the hockey game or soccer game, then you make yourself a human. You become a real person to them. And then it's much harder for them to dehumanize you and act callously toward you.
We talk about narcissists and psychopaths in politics, whoever we may be talking about in any given moment, Leanne, with this sort of stuff. I used to think, Leanne, rather naively, that democracy was the best shield against a psychopath taking high office. I thought somehow the presentation of that psychopathic personality would be obvious to the greater group of people, but it doesn't seem to be the case. What tends to happen to psychopaths as they attempt to climb the greasy pole of politics? Do they get found out, or is this really quite common for a psychopath to climb to the top?
So we do know that people with dark traits, including psychopathy and narcissism, are more interested in politics. And so therefore more likely to kind of throw their hat into the ring than someone with fewer such traits. What's also really interesting is that if you give people kind of a test about politics, people with high levels of narcissism also score more poorly on that test. So like they're really interested in politics. They don't really know a lot about it, but they're really interested in it. And we know that these dark personalities, they like power. They like to domineer people. In some ways, maybe they're able to move up or gain support because, particularly for narcissistic individuals, their confidence comes across as competence. Like we just see someone who's, you know, so comfortable in front of the camera and seems to have an answer for every question, and we assume that they're going to be really good at this job. We confuse that confidence and competence. And so people might assume that they would be better at this job than they might actually be.
Is there something in humans in general that wants to rally around such confident bullying figures? There's something in us that admires strength, no matter what its foundation is and how it's being wielded. We just kind of get a bit dazzled by the light of that.
I think that's true under particular circumstances. So we have these really fascinating studies that suggest whenever people are in the midst of a military conflict or in the midst of economic uncertainty, you know, which characterizes a lot of the world right now. And whenever people essentially are scared, they look for a strong leader, right? So they want someone who's going to make that right. And so these individuals with dark traits, they project that strength. I think the problem with, you know, latching ourselves to those personalities is assuming that we can trust them to use that strength in ways that are beneficial for everybody as opposed to, you know, focusing on themselves.
Is it enough for a psychopath to win, or do they need someone to lose as well?
Oh, that's a great question. They love when other people lose. So they don't just want to win. They want to dominate other people. And we studied this in these weird little decomposed games where essentially we say there's three different ways that we can allocate these points. And we don't even really tell them what the points mean, but presumably more points is better. And they will choose a situation in which they get fewer points themselves, but where the next person gets way less points than them. They would prefer that scenario than making more points, but where the next closest person is pretty close behind them in terms of points tally. So, meaning they love relative advantage over other people. They want to dominate people. They don't want to, you know, share the wealth, and they don't want to win by just a little. They want to win by a lot.
And is seeing the disappointment on the loser's face a part of their enjoyment as well? Or is it just enough for them to know that they've beaten this person, that this other person has been defeated?
That's a good question. I don't think we have good empirical data on that specific question. But we do know that people with dark personalities experience more of that Schadenfreude. So they really enjoy other people's failure more than people with fewer such traits. So you could imagine that that would translate to that relative advantage scenario.
Another trait that's been observed in the psychopath is the pleasure they seem to take, or they often take, in conning people, in deceiving people, duping people. Have you found that to be borne out by your research as well?
We do have good evidence to suggest that people with high levels of these traits experience a kind of duping delight. So whereas most people, after they tell a lie, they feel kind of nervous and guilty about it, they seem to experience more joy. And interestingly, this might create this kind of positive feedback loop, whereas most people lie relatively infrequently because it's kind of an aversive experience, you know, like you tell a lie and it didn't feel good. I don't want to feel that again. I'm not going to lie very often. They have the opposite experience. They tell a lie and then that feels really fun, you know, especially if they got away with it. But even if they didn't, they got kind of a rush out of it. And that in turn makes it more likely that they'll lie again in the future. And so that positive kind of duping delight experience might actually be like a positive reinforcer and might help explain why they tend to lie more than the average person.
Now, you've got some advice in your book on how people might be able to spot a dark personality in 10 seconds or less, you say, starting with lying. Now, it's often said that shifty eyes are a sign that someone's lying. But is that actually true, Leanne?
If you go around the world and you ask people, you know, how do you detect lies? What's the number one thing that a liar does that helps you to reveal their deception? People in dozens of countries around the world will say a liar can't look you in the eye. A liar shifts their gaze. And researchers have done like hundreds of studies on this at this point, and there is no evidence to suggest that liars look you in the eye any less than truth tellers. And if you think about it for like two more seconds, it becomes obvious why that doesn't work. And it's because all of us lie sometimes, and all of us know that stereotype. And so we're like, if I want to get away with this lie, I better not look up and to the right or up and to the left. I better make normal eye contact. And people are pretty good at managing their eye contact. So I think the first thing is to abandon some of those false stereotypes, things like liars can't look you in the eye. Liars also do not fidget more than truth tellers. So you can wipe those off your slate.
Okay. What are some better clues to assess whether someone's telling a great big pork pie in front of your face, Leanne?
Verbal cues tend to work a lot better than nonverbal cues. Focus on what people say. Liars will tell you less detailed stories than truth tellers will. And that's because lies are constructed. You know, we need to create a story out of thin air. And that is really hard to do. You need to think about what that other person knows. You want to make sure you don't contradict that information. You also want to tell a coherent story and you don't want to give anything away. And you also need to not trip yourself up. The easiest way to do that is to give a relatively short, simple story. Whereas truth tellers, you know, they can just recall it from memory and it's got all kinds of visual details and auditory details. And it's got way more details in general than a lie.
Facial expressions can sometimes be helpful. And I don't want to make too much of a thing of this, but it is kind of fascinating, the case you bring forward in your book about how when you were actually researching this very thing, this famous case came to the public's attention in Canada at the time. And this was the disappearance of a girl called Carissa Beaudreau, who was reported missing. This is back in 2008. Now, this made all the news headlines, and her mother went on television. Her mother, Penny, went on TV to make an appeal. What did you observe as you were watching Penny Beaudreau making this appeal on TV?
I think she might be involved in the disappearance of her daughter.
Why?
Because I had just started studying exactly these kinds of cases. So I was really interested in emotional facial expressions and how they might differ between lies and truths. And I was studying them in the lab, and that just seemed, you know, very artificial. And so I was like, I want to study some real high-stakes lies. Like, where are people telling lies that have a ton of emotion and a ton of stakes on the line? And I was inspired by this paper where they studied these people who had gone on TV doing exactly what Penny Beaudreau had done, asking for help, trying to find their missing loved one who had gone missing. And they had collected some videos where that person was eventually convicted of killing the person they were pleading to find. So this was a huge whopper of a lie they were telling on national television. And they also had videos in which people were also pleading for help, trying to find their missing loved one, but had nothing to do with their disappearance. And so I was like, I could compare these kinds of cases to see if the facial expressions are different for the liars and the truth tellers. And as I was just starting that research, I came home from school one day and saw Penny Beaudreau on the nightly news. And her video, her emotional presentation looked a lot more like the liars that I was watching than the truth tellers.
You see, that's a hell of a thing for me to hear you say that, because I took the trouble of seeing that on YouTube, her appeal, and she's weeping. She looks incredibly distressed. She absolutely looked 100% genuine to me. What did you see that I missed there?
Okay, Richard, you need to go back and watch that video, because there is part where she's got like a Kleenex and she's kind of dabbing her face, right? But there's no tears there. There's no like water on her face. And her emotional facial expression also gave it away. So if you go back and you look again, you'll see that her eyebrows come like straight up. She almost looks more surprised than sad, really. And if you just try it right now, if you try to appear sad in like your upper face, so you pull just your inner eyebrow upward and together, it's really hard to do that compared to just pulling your whole eyebrow upward. Because you have to like pull your inner eyebrows together, but also pull them upward at the same time. That's the action associated with sadness. That's pretty hard to fake. And so if you go back and look more at her video, what you'll see is a lot of what looks like surprise, that full eyebrow upward, as opposed to that kind of just inner furrowed brow raise.
Well, it turns out the police shared your suspicions, and she was induced into making an unconscious confession. It turns out then she pled guilty. She had actually, it turns out, had murdered her own daughter because she believed the daughter was getting in the way of her relationship with her boyfriend.
Yeah, the circumstances are completely horrific. I think, you know, I was not surprised given what I had observed, but I do think there's like a lot of caution to take from that observation that I made, because any given behavior is not a Pinocchio's nose. There is no Pinocchio's nose. Like, even in those really high stakes emotional situations, there's not one behavior or even a mix of different behaviors that can tell you this person is for sure lying. At the very most, it can help you to decide what to ask more questions about, or like maybe we need to look further into this person. But certainly that kind of emotional facial expression analysis is certainly not enough on its own to drive an investigation.
Now, you've listed strategies in your book for managing these dark personalities, for protecting oneself and encouraging better behavior in them. This is, of course, for people who can't just simply walk away from them. The first is to establish clear boundaries and enforce them. But Leanne, do such people even respond to rules as such that you may lay down for them?
They're more likely to respond to rules that are laid down than rules that are not laid down. And so if you are relying on workplace norms to try to keep people in line, they're much more likely to break those norms than they are if you've got, say, a respectful workplace policy actually written down. And if they are engaging in some inappropriate behavior, you actually have a set of rules written out that you can say, you have violated this rule. And maybe there's some sort of punishment. Maybe eventually they get fired. But without those rules written down, dark personalities tend to be very likely to manipulate the gray area.
Second rule is, and amen to this, don't hand them power over others.
Yeah, I mean, people with dark personalities are just like anyone else in that they have other skills and abilities, and they may be amazing at their job. And if they are good, they deserve, you know, some sort of reward like anybody else. But that could be, you know, something else that they like a big fat raise or a corner office with a view, maybe a new title. But I would really caution against promotion to a managerial role, because we have tons of evidence to suggest that people with these personalities reign abuse and create stress and turnover in the people who work below them. I think people are quite aware that, you know, there's a handful of these people in their midst and they can be kind of a pain. But I don't know that people really realize how outsized the harm that a small portion of people can cause. You know, I was reading one article yesterday and they had examined over 2 million Swedish citizens, and they looked at how many of those people had been convicted of violent crimes. There was 1% of that 2 million people were responsible for 63% of violent crimes. And, you know, we find obviously not the exact same numbers, but something kind of similar in workplaces, where if you have just one person with these dark traits on a team, you get incredible amounts of stress on other people. You get more of that turnover. You get decreased performance. You even get the employees below them kind of taking that stress home and like taking it out on their family. And so the ripple effects are really huge.
The fourth one you have is to use the carrot, not the stick. In other words, to say, do this properly and you'll get a bonus, rather than do this wrong, mm-hmm. I'll drop you down the elevator shaft, which is what I really feel like doing. Mm-hmm. Does hope work better than fear with such people?
Yes. There are actually neurological differences between people who have really high levels of psychopathic traits and those with relatively low ones, in that they have smaller and less active amygdala. And that's like a fear center in the brain. And it's involved in processing punishment. So whenever I or you get punished, Richard, you're like, oh, I'm not going to do that again because I remember how that went last time and that was not fun. Their brains don't respond the same way. And so punishment is less effective as a way to shape their behavior. Now, there's probably still a role for punishment. You do need to call their attention to it. It's kind of an attention problem. So if you're going to punish them, make sure they notice it. But what it turns out they're really responsive to is reward. Like, they are very reward driven. And so if you want to shape their behavior, providing a reward for engaging in the behavior you want is probably going to be more effective than providing a punishment for the behavior that you don't want.
The next point you've got is that you suggest you should become a detective around such people. Do you mean by that, like, verify the stuff that these people are telling to you or putting to you?
Absolutely. So mostly we go through our lives believing the things that other people tell us. So that's another part of my research program. And we consistently find that people have a truth bias. So they tend to believe what they're told. And that makes a ton of sense, because most of the time, most people tell the truth. And so we just like cut out all that kind of extra brain work of trying to discern the veracity of every statement by accepting things as true. But that doesn't work. That actually makes us pretty vulnerable to dark personalities because they use deception far more than the average person. And so whenever you're interacting with them, it's not like a trust but verify. It's kind of like a just verify all the time. And so you can try to institute some transparency into, say, your workplace so that you make that verification a little bit easier.
And finally, and this is a really good bit of advice, avoid face-to-face negotiations. How does that help?
This is a really interesting one, and it comes at least in part from the kind of superficial charm that dark personalities can exude and the way that they kind of dominate people in face-to-face interactions. So in one negotiation study, participants had these concert tickets, and they were supposed to sell them to another person. Sometimes this happened in an in-person conversation. Other times it happened via text. And what the researchers found is that people with higher levels of dark personalities got way more money for their tickets whenever they were interacting face-to-face. But whenever things shifted to text, that advantage went away. And so it seems as though their superficial charm is eliminated whenever they're reduced to words on a page rather than their vivacious big personalities that show up in person. And so if you have something, you know, important that you need to negotiate, doing that over text helps for that reason. But it also gives you a record of what was said. And if you are concerned about potential violence, if this is a domestic violence situation, it also, you know, gives you some literal physical distance between yourself and this person, which might also keep you physically safe. So there's a ton of different reasons to kind of shift to text when interacting or when negotiating with someone with these dark traits.
I think what you write about how people can become situationally psychopathic is completely fascinating, Leanne. And I maybe wonder whether this kind of personal horror and revulsion I have and most people have towards psychopaths is a kind of form of projection. Are we sort of projecting on them everything we don't like about ourselves or with things we don't like about ourselves when we're behaving at our worst?
Yeah, there's a kind of weird irony in the fact that people are incredibly callous about the people that are incredibly callous, right? So, you know, whenever I talk about dark personality, even when I talk about these traits that show up in kids, there tends to be like a lock them up and throw away the key type of mentality. If you look in the comments section, it is like scary what people are suggesting we do with people with high levels of these traits. And I was like, that sounds a lot like what they might say. So I think you're totally right that we can be a bit holier than thou, which in some situations might be true. But it's also worth noting that we all fall somewhere along this spectrum for dark traits. So they're not like an all or none type of phenomenon. Everyone falls somewhere from very low to very high. And so if we want to see less callousness, less manipulation, and less selfishness in the world, one great place to start is by like turning down the dial in ourselves.
You talk about a social experiment that was done in the 1950s that was called the Robber's Cave Experiment. Can you tell me a bit about that experiment and how it worked?
Yeah, so this is kind of a classic social psych experiment in which at the Robber's Cave Boys Camp in Oklahoma, they had two sets of boys. These were like 12, 13-year-old boys, unknown to each other for the first few weeks of camp. So they developed this kind of like very strong in-group identity, right? And they gave themselves names and they had flags. And so they really loved and cared about each other. And then they were introduced to each other and they like hated each other.
This is the two separate groups, is it?
Exactly. You know, they would like raid each other's bunks and steal things from each other. So there's this real like in-group, out-group animosity. And what the researchers wanted to know is like, okay, now that we've got this, these two groups of boys who seem to hate each other, how do we get them to like each other again? And what they determined was that the two sets of boys had to work together toward a shared goal that they couldn't achieve on their own. So one was like they needed to pool money to be able to afford to like rent this movie that they all wanted to watch together. Another was like a bus got stuck in a ditch and all the boys needed to help push it out, not just half of the boys, right? And so whenever they started to work together toward a shared goal, that animosity started to dissipate.
We're living in a time where social media has empowered all kinds of malignant personality types, brought out the worst too in some otherwise quite otherwise nice people. And this is the world we've made for ourselves now. This is kind of where we all have online road rage, really, at each other, sitting in these kind of vessels where we can be anonymous if we want to and hurl abuse at one another. But tell me about what you come to understand about the power of being a kind of a reasonably decent human being in a bad time in a bad place.
I think that there's a world in which, you know, you can talk about dark personalities and it just becomes a real bummer. You focus on those malevolent few and you kind of feel disempowered. They're like, there's nothing that we can do about this. But there's actually, I think, a really hopeful message in here, which is that there are these malevolent few, but few is an important word there. And so we don't have to change like all of humanity to change the way that we see the world. We need to identify and contain a handful of people who do a huge amount of harm in the world. And so if we're able to, you know, identify, say, that 10-ish percent of people who have really high levels of these traits, or even just 1% who have clinical levels of these traits, we could cut out like 50% of the crime. And so there's a lot of benefits to recognizing these personalities, learning how to manage them, but also recognizing that they are not a monolith. They are not all of us. And there are a ton of honest and kind and helpful people out there. And in fact, they are the majority of people. I think you're right. Like behind our keyboards, everything seems a little bit scary. And even there, you know, you go into the comments and you see all kinds of vitriol. But even there, it's like 1% or less of the people who are commenting are doing all of that ugly stuff in the comments. So it's a handful of people are making things seem way worse than it needs to be.
It's been completely fascinating speaking with you, Leanne. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks.
Leanne Tenbrink's book is called Poisonous People: Psychopathy, Narcissism, Manipulation, Sadism, How to Resist Them and Improve Your Life.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Today's conversation with Leanne Tenbrink was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. The producer was Maggie Morris. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.